ready to hear argument on cost number DO-621 and 2753, the combined cases of First Title Company of Waco and Alamo Title Insurance Company versus Charles Garrett and Dorinda Garrett and Willingham Auto World and Eugene Jones.
Okay, please report. Mr. Brent Kipper and Mr. Dick Davis present arguments for petitioners. Mr. Kipper will open for 13 minutes. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Kipper, with regards to the placement of the easel and the charge, that the problem is we can't see that far. Whoever
is their chart, that's fine with me. In fact, I would stand back here for the spirit.
Well, you may want to consider that when you use your chart. No problem. You didn't make it any better, but that's up to you. Whatever you think is going to make you some points is all right with us.
May it please the court, I believe with respect to the case that we're involved in, there are two issues that are presented for this court's consideration. First is whether or not a Deceptive Trade Practices Act defendant is entitled to a dollar credit for settlements made by other parties who are potentially liable under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. And second, what showing must the non-settling defendant make in order to obtain such credit? Now, the credit was moved for in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals denied the defendants the credit in this case. Originally, in the court's initial opinion, the Court of Appeals held that this case was governed by the Duncan case and that the credit was not available. The court held that the only reduction that was available for settling defendants was through a percentage reduction, and that since the defendants in this case had not submitted questions to the jury, they were not entitled to the percentage reduction. On motion for rehearing, it was pointed out to the court that this case was not governed by Duncan because it involved neither strict liability, breach of warranty, as required by the Duncan decision, and that we believe we were still entitled to the credit. In their opinion upon the motion for rehearing, the Court of Appeals again denied the credit to the defendants, holding that the defendants, in order to be entitled to the credit, were required to show that the settling defendants were joint tort feasors as required under the Palestine Contractors versus Perkins decision. It's the position of the defendants that the Court of Appeals decision is contrary to this court's recent decision in Stewart Title versus Sterling, and that under the Sterling decision, we are entitled to the credit for the settlements made by the other defendants in our case. The first point, we believe, is that the case, as far as contribution is concerned and credit for settlement, is governed by Chapter 32 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. This case was filed after September 2, 1987, so it's not governed by Duncan. Chapter 33, as this court noted in the Sterling decision, does not apply to cases under 21.21 of the Insurance Code or the DTPA, except to the extent that Section 1750 makes it applicable. Given that consideration, if there are no rights under Chapter 33, then by default, this case falls under Chapter 32, which governs general contribution for tort action. This court noted in the Sterling decision that a cause of action under under 21.21 of the Insurance Code was tortious in nature, sounded in tort, and therefore the rights of contribution among defendants and the determination of credits for settlements would be governed by Chapter 32. Now, as this court pointed out in the Sterling case, Chapter 32 really does not address what happens when defendants settle, how you address the allocation of the settlement proceeds or the reduction as far as the percentage of liability attributable to those defendants. Rather, this is common law that has built up over the years, probably in excess of 100 years as far as governing the rights of the defendants in that situation. Over the last 60 or 70 years, there's been two alternatives that have developed under Chapter 32. One is the dollar credit or the dollar reduction which arises out of the one satisfaction rule of Baylor versus Bradshaw. The second alternative is, of course, the pro rata reduction, which initially was addressed in Cotegno versus the Parisian back in 1932, and then later in Palestine Contractors versus Perkins in 1964, which basically says if you have four defendants, two of them settle, if you prove that those two were joint tortfeasors, then the remaining defendants are entitled to a reduction of two-fourths or 50% of the judgment which may ultimately be entered against the defendants. Now, in this case, well, first off, with respect to the pro rata reduction, the cases have been fairly explicit that in order to be entitled to the pro rata reduction, the defendant must obtain certain jury findings from the jury, that he must plead and prove that the settling defendants were joint tortfeasors and actually obtained jury findings. That was not done in this case. No question about that. That was not done in this case. The defendants in this case are not seeking a pro rata reduction pursuant to either Cotegno versus the Parisian or Palestine Contractors versus Perkins. That has never been our position. You look at the elections we made in our answers and in the motions following the verdict in this case. That has not been our position. Rather, the election that was made by the defendants in this case is for the dollar credit pursuant to the Baylor versus Bradshaw rule that developed starting back in 1932 to 1935, the Commission Appeals decisions. Now, under the Baylor versus Bradshaw rule, you're not required to show that the settling defendants are joint tortfeasors. This is what the Court of Appeals held, and that simply is not correct. There are numerous decisions that have been decided since Baylor versus Bradshaw which have held that. Caterpillar versus Boyette, Skyline Cab versus Bradley, McMullen versus Scott, and most recently was this court's own decision in Sterling versus Stewart Title, where in footnote 10, this court noted the distinction between the pro rata reduction, which requires a jury finding of joint tortfeasor status, and the dollar reduction, which does not require such a finding. If you look back through the cases, in order to be entitled to the dollar credit, generally the courts have held that the defendant must establish three things. One is the existence of a settlement. Second, the amount of the settlement. And third, that the money was paid for a single injury. That is, that the damages which the plaintiff was compensated for by the settling defendants are the same damages which the plaintiff was seeking from the non-settling defendant. But they're not separate damages. Now, we believe that in this case, the evidence that was introduced at the trial court supports the entitlement of the defendants in this case to a dollar credit. Specifically, Plaintiff's Exhibit 36, which was introduced for the purposes of the court, was the settlement agreement that was entered into by the plaintiffs and the sellers in this case of the real estate that was purchased. In our case, the defendants who settled were not parties to our suit. There were two separate lawsuits that settled one and proceeded with our lawsuit against the title company and against the title agent. However, there were recitations in the agreement which were introduced to the trial court. Particularly on page 2, the plaintiffs in our case stated, whereas the Garretts, who are the plaintiffs, make claims for the recovery of money, rescission of the sale of land, and attorney's fees because of the alleged misrepresentations made by Jenkins and Dameron, who were the two settling defendants, when they sold the land to Garretts, among other allegations contained in the pleadings of the Garretts, which are hereby incorporated by reference as if fully set forth at length herein. Later on page 6 of the settlement agreement, which was introduced again to the trial court, the last sentence states that the parties anticipate and believe that claims will be made and litigation will continue and or be instituted, which involves the same factual basis of this suit, but involving title insurance companies, abstract and title companies, and possibly others. To be specific, the Garretts have already instituted a suit, cause number 88-2452-3, about Charles C. Garrett and Dorinda Garrett versus First Title Company of Waco, the case we're here on today. So it's our position that the settlement agreement sets forth the fact that they're making claims in the underlying case for misrepresentation, the same claims that were being made in the case before this court. There was also evidence introduced outside the hearing of the jury on pages 307 and 308 of the statement of facts where the plaintiffs are questioned regarding the settlements that were entered into between Jenkins and Demery. And specifically, they go into the details of the settlement, how much they received in cash, and I believe the cash total they received was $62,000 plus forgiveness of debt in the amount of $7,000. In conclusion, it's the position in this case that the plaintiffs have already been compensated for part of their losses. The defendants made the necessary evidentiary showing to be entitled to the dollar credit. And under Chapter 32, and under this court's decision, in Stewart Title versus Sterling, the defendants are entitled to a credit of $62,000.
Now, Mr. Cooper, the liability of the sellers of the land, I don't know what ultimately that would have been. They apparently settled at the value of the land not being as great as the buyers assumed the land would have been, but for the failure to advise them of the restriction on how to use the land. A title policy's obligation is to assure a clear and marketable title. And I don't know what ultimately led to the decision against the title company, but it somehow had to be premised on not having clear and marketable title. Is there not a requirement on the part of the party claiming the dollar-for-dollar credit to establish the damages found in the trial of the case are the same damages recovered or recoverable under the settlement? Not, what I'm saying is there's a different set of damages for a claim against a title company that assures clear and marketable title and against a seller of land to the value of land as much as it's still marketable. I could sell it, but I can't sell it for as much as I wanted to sell it for. It seems to me there's a difference that they pay in settlement for the value puts the buyers of the land now in a position as if they bought the land and that representation had not occurred. It's just not worth as much, and they got some money back. The title company, on the other hand, was saying it's worth, I'll clear your title for you.
If this case that we're hearing today was a pure contract suit on a title policy, I would agree with you. However, both lawsuits, the one involving Jenkins and Dameron and the one involving the title companies, were for misrepresentation. And they alleged that because of the misrepresentation, first, the title or the property wasn't worth as much, and second, they sustained all these consequential losses because they could not operate the business, the junkyard business, on the property that they wanted to. Our case was a misrepresentation case. It was submitted as a misrepresentation case. The case against Dameron and against Jenkins was also tried as a misrepresentation case. If this was a pure contract case, which typically title policy cases are, I would tend to agree with you, but that's not the way our case was tried. It was tried as a misrepresentation case. You look at the charge submitted to the jury. It was a DPPA case. They said we made certain misrepresentations in connection with the title commitment letter and whatnot, and that was on the basis of misrepresentation. They're also saying that the Jenkins and Dameron also made misrepresentations, and that they also, these two people, also failed to disclose the existence of the restricted customs. The misrepresentation on the part of Jenkins and Dameron was failure to disclose the restricted covenant. The alleged misrepresentation on the part of the title company was failure to disclose the restricted covenant. And we believe the allegations are the same and that the damages sought are the same, as established by the settlement agreement, which was marked and introduced as Exhibit Number 36.
Thank you,
if there are no further questions, I will yield the remainder of my time to Mr. Davis.
Please, the court. I'm here on behalf of Willingham Auto World in the Coe case with this one. In this case, the only question, I believe, that is before the court is whether, in fact, the injuries sustained by Mr. Jones were indivisible or, in fact, divisible injuries. The case came out of a sale of a motor home to Mr. Jones by Winnebago Industries. Willingham Auto World subsequently worked on the motor home in its service department after Mr. Jones had problems. Mr. Jones subsequently sued Winnebago and Willingham, alleging that they were jointly and severally liable for violations of the Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act. He maintained that position up until shortly before trial, at which time he settled with Winnebago for $8,000, and then amended his pleading to allege solely claims against Willingham. The case went to trial after Willingham had elected, prior to trial, during trial, before the case was submitted to the jury, and after the jury verdict, had elected to take a dollar-for-dollar credit for the settlement of Winnebago under the Bradshaw case. The court denied that settlement, or that credit, and gave an instruction to the jury in the damages issues of the charge, telling the jury to disregard anything done by Winnebago and to only award damages for those things done by Willingham. It's our position that that cannot be done in this case, simply because the damages or the injury to Mr. Jones was indivisible because of the very nature of the case. The evidence in the case showed that Mr. Jones had problems with his vehicle almost from day one, that it was a vehicle that was notorious in the industry, that it was a vehicle that was, as one serviceman called, a piece of junk and rated a zero on a scale of 1 to 10. It was a bad vehicle. Willingham did not sell the vehicle. Willingham only tried to repair it after Mr. Jones brought it to him. Mr. Jones admitted that he had problems with the engine, transmission, and various parts of the vehicle from the day he got it and prior to the time it was worked on by Willingham. It was simply a bad vehicle and admittedly a lemon. In addition to the evidence that the court has to review, the plaintiff pleaded that this injury was indivisible. He pleaded that Willingham and Winnebago were jointly and severally liable. This court, took note of the fact that in the Stewart case, Plaintiff Sterling had himself alleged the joint nature of the defendant's liability to him. And this court held the fact that an alleged tortfeasor has settled with one who is ultimately found to be a tortfeasor is sufficient in a case under Bradshaw to award a credit to the non-settling tortfeasor. In this case, When the case went to trial, the jury came back with a verdict of approximately $7,200. It resulted with prejudgment interest in a judgment of just under $8,000. We moved the court for an offset under Bradshaw in the amount of $8,000, which would have resulted in a take-nothing judgment, and that's what we believe should have been done. The fact that plaintiff argued after he had gotten his settlement with Winnebago that this is no longer a joint and several case, it doesn't change the things. Yes,
to get to your point that the trial court erroneously submitted the instruction, would you have to satisfy us that there is no evidence in the record that Willingham created any damages separate and apart from Winnebago?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the question...
If there is any evidence in the record of separate damages caused by Willingham, then wouldn't the instruction be correct? And if the instruction is correct, then you no longer can pursue your argument that you're entitled to dollar for dollar credit. The only thing you're entitled to do is to, I guess, argue that there's only a scintilla of evidence that would support the $7,000. I guess you don't on this court, I don't yield sufficient evidence.
Your Honor, we're not challenging the evidence in this case. We're challenging the fact we did not get the credit.
But you would not be entitled, if there is any evidence that Willingham caused separate damages, then you wouldn't be entitled to credit, would you?
I believe we would be. The reason being that this was a case that there may be some elements of damage caused by Willingham that were separate from the joint damages caused by Hall. There may be separate damages caused by Winnebago that were included in its settlement. That does not change the basic nature of the case. There may be, and let me apologize to the court for a mistake in the analogy in the application for writ of error. That the analogy is flat backwards. My partner wrote that analogy and said that if someone's injured in an automobile accident due to the fault of a driver, goes to the hospital, is treated by the physician, ultimately sues them both, the physician can't get it separated. In fact, he can, as counsel properly pointed out in his response. The difference being, can the automobile driver get any credit, or can the automobile driver get any credit from the fact that the physician subsequently caused additional injury? And the fact and the answer is no under Texas law. He's jointly responsible for everything. I believe what the question is, would the instruction, if there was any evidence of separate damages, make any difference? I don't believe the instruction makes any difference. The question is, are we entitled to an offset because the injuries are in fact indivisible?
Well, the question was this. The trial court instructs the jury to consider only damages caused by Willingham. That's what poses a problem for your taking credit, because you're saying, no, it's all the same damage. But they instruct the jury to find only separate damages. My question then goes, if there is some evidence in the record that justifies the submission of the instruction, then don't you lose on your request for the credit?
I don't believe we do. Primarily judged from the standpoint that the whole case is an indivisible case, and the policy aspect of that can be, the ramifications of it are frightening. In joint and several claims, when ultimately at the point of trial somebody settles, and then the judge, in order to cure all of that, no matter what the claim is, just says to the jury, don't find anything contributed to by the other defendant who's already settled.
May it please the court, Mr. Andy McSwain and Mr. Roland Brown will present arguments for respondents. Mr. Brown will open for 7 minutes.
May it please the court, I'm taking 7 minutes in deference to the larger amount of damages and what I also believe is a little more complex legal issues presented by the companion case. That doesn't mean that the case is not viewed as important. I don't know where my gallery went from earlier this morning, but Mr. Jones back in Jacksonville considers it an important case, and I think it has an important legal application. I think it's been already pointed out that we're looking here at separate actors who produced separate injuries, which produced separate and divisible damages. I was a little concerned when we were consolidated with the other case because I had difficulty understanding the indivisible versus divisible as opposed to the case with which I was consolidated. It's not my intention to argue for or against either side in the other case. But I feel it's important to differentiate between Stewart title as well as first title in this instance. And I am going to rely upon the brief a great deal there because we've gone through and pointed out in the statement of facts where I, as trial counsel, from the very beginning of the trial, carefully segregated specific acts and specific damages. The charge, obviously, I believe, is the key in this case. The judge presented the charge or gave the charge as I requested. The very intention was to, in fact, segregate those acts out and let the jury do that. If they could do so based on the evidence, they were able to do so. I believe the trial court judgment as well as the court of appeals judgment can be upheld on three separate bases as outlined in the brief. The first being a somewhat technical one, the second one I believe a fairly practical one, and the third a somewhat therapeutic one. I tend towards the practical one because I think that's probably the best place to look. I think technically they simply have not brought forward a proper point of error. As is pointed out, they're not attacking the sufficiency of the evidence, nor the specific wording of the charge. I think they've waived error under Rule 74D, as well as under the Bardillo case. As to the other issue, we just, in this case, simply never get to issues of joint responsibility because of the case, the way the case was tried. The case was originally pleaded as joint and several, not as indivisible. I don't believe there's anything in the pleadings that ever referred to the individual as indivisible. But in fact, we did amend before trial, after settlement, and tried the case entirely on the issue of specific acts in the charge. I think it's not as important now as after having heard Mr. Davis' statement. But again, Auto World committed specific acts to cause specific injuries, to cause specific damages. Winnebago did the same thing. Now, they didn't commit any joint acts because they never operated jointly together, but they did commit some joint acts that caused joint injury and joint damage, and those were specifically excluded from the jury's consideration. The fact that the jury verdict came back at something close to the settlement was merely coincidental. If the court looked at the entire record, the original damages sought were in the neighborhood of $28,000, and I believe that was exclusive or largely exclusive of attorney's fees. So Mr. Jones was in no way made whole, even with both the judgment and the settlement. And I think, in fact, they are challenging the evidence. They're saying we simply can't segregate or divide these injuries when, in fact, that's exactly what we did, and the jury had no trouble going back to the jury room. And so finding with a very specific instruction staring them in the face in the charge. Just by way of illustration, Willingham Auto World took the vehicle in to do some work on it, was supposed to change the oil. They didn't bother to put the oil back in. When my client picked it up and drove it from Tyler to Jacksonville, it tore up the engine. It had nothing to do with being a bad vehicle. It would have happened to a Lincoln Continental. You don't put the oil in, you drive it 30 miles, you've got a bad engine. Clearly divisible. They broke off a bracket underneath the vehicle where it could not be seen. Didn't bother to tell my client nor to fix it. Had nothing to do with the design of the vehicle. They just broke it off and didn't tell them. Now, there was a transmission replacement. There was a delay in getting the transmission. The transmission was bad because Winnebago did a bad job of designing this vehicle, and that's pretty well admitted. But there was some delay that we thought was attributable to the fact that the service department at Willingham just didn't get with the program. We didn't ask for those damages. We didn't argue for those at trial because I couldn't figure out how to differentiate between how much of that was the responsibility of Winnebago and how much was the responsibility of Willingham. But we simply excluded those damages and didn't deal with them at trial. There are many, many other similar instances. The divisibility issue, I think, is spoken to by Landers versus East Texas Saltwater Disposal, by a Austin Court of Appeals case, Paschal versus Peavy, and by this court's own case in Stewart Title. The court clearly points out that in that case, there was a single indivisible injury. Here, we simply don't have that situation, and that's my concern, is that the court distinguished my case from both Stewart and from First Title on that particular point. So then I think any of the three bases would stand. The third bases or basis would be the public policy argument, and that is simply, and I harken back to the Dobson cases that I cited in the brief, where it's pointed out that even if you go back and pick up the Bradshaw rule, the one recovery rule, that sort of thing, that can't be allowed to contravene the clearly enunciated public policy in the state of Texas as found in the DPPA. The absurdity of it is pointed out when Willingham, who messes his vehicle up consistently, doesn't tell anybody what they've done, says we didn't do anything. If we did anything, it was mostly the other guy's fault. Now they say it was all the other guy's fault, or we want it to be all his fault. We want to rely on his credit. A jury finds them not just to have engaged in these deceptive actions, but to have knowingly engaged in them. They submit a judgment to the trial court in which they say we would like for the plaintiff, who has gone to the trouble of making a reasonable settlement with Winnebago, of trying this case, of carefully setting out the elements of damage that are limited to Willingham, we want the plaintiff to take zero and we'd like for him to pay half the court costs. So I think the public policy issue is certainly there, but I think that's a broad issue. I'd like to narrow it down and look particularly, as we have, at the practical issue. The fact we just don't reach the issues of Bradshaw, of Duncan, of the various comparative causation schemes, because there's nothing to compare causation with. They just weren't the same damages. And I'll yield the balance of the time.
Any questions?
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Andy McSwain. I represent the respondents, Charlie and Dorinda Garrett, and First Title Company versus Garrett. I'd like to point out at the beginning that we recognize at this point that we are in fact governed by this court's opinion in Stewart Title versus Sterling. We are here today basically on the basis that there is no showing in the record in the First Title Company case that in fact the sellers of the property and First Title, which includes First Title Company and Alamo Title, are joint tort features. Now, First Title has taken the position before the court that...
Did you not plead joint, that they were joint tort features?
Judge, the way this came about, our clients purchased this land shortly after they sought to open their auto salvage yard, which was essentially covered by restrictive covenants. The grantors won back from our sellers, sued to enjoin us from opening the auto salvage yard. In that case, we joined the seller and sued them for, as is shown in the settlement agreement that's part of this record, basically the only thing that's part of this record with respect to that case, sued them for money damages, rescission, and attorney's fees. First Title and Alamo Title were not a part of that case. That case was settled before it ever went to the jury. First Title and Alamo Title were sued for different damages in a separate case, and there was no allegation in either one of the cases that First Title and Alamo Title were joint tort feasors with the prior sellers.
How can they not be? You didn't get the title you wanted.
Well, it's our position, it's our opinion, that they are not joint tort feasors because, and don't confuse joint tort feasors with joint actors. Joint tort feasors in the Stewart Title is there one indivisible injury? If you look to the Landers case, Landers says it is an indivisible injury if it can create joint and several liability. If the damages cannot be fairly and reasonably apportioned between the various parties. In our case, as between the sellers and as between First Title, the damages could be fairly and reasonably apportioned as to the parties.
How?
First Title could not be liable, for instance, for punitive damages, as could the sellers, because First Title, they weren't black-hearted in it.
But if you could prove they were.
But in this case, they were not.
It was just so if you could prove they were.
If you could prove that they were, and in Stewart Title, the same allegations were made against all of the defendants. They were all black-hearted. They all participated to some extent in the misrepresentation.
So if you could prove punitive damages against the title company, then they would be joint tort feasors with the seller?
Not as to the punitive damages component. As to the actual damages component, they might be. First Title also could not be liable for rescission, which the seller could be, and that was part of the suit against the seller. First Title also would not be liable for the attorney's fees that the Garretts incurred in their case against Jenkins and Damley.
Let me ask you this. If I buy a piece of property because I want to do something on it.
Yes, sir.
And I discover a restrictive covenant that prohibits me from doing what I wanted to do on it.
Yes, sir.
So I sue for my damages. And one of those that I sue for my damages pays me X number of dollars. But I sue two or three other people for my damage. My damage is I have a piece of property that I can't do what I want. What difference does it make if all the people in the chain of title have different responsibility toward those damages? That is why you say it's got to be joint liability. I mean, I just have acres of property that doesn't do what I want it to do. Why isn't everybody liable for whatever that is? Well,
you're correct to some extent. You're correct to some extent. For instance, going back to, for instance, the punitive damages. In this case, there wasn't any evidence of gross neglect, you know, knowing or malicious conduct on the part of...
Punitive damages is a punishment on a particular wrongdoer. That has no relationship. Be careful. There's supposed to be some relationship between punitive and actual damages, but there's no relationship between the plaintiff... I mean, the punitive dollar applies to a punishment factor of the individual. That's
right.
Individual defendant.
Right.
So I don't think this is a situation where there's dollar dollar credit on punitive.
You're correct. The law is this. Dollar-for-dollar credit applies to the common components of damages between the various parties. In other words, if there are joint tortfeasors and they all act together the same to cause the same indivisible injury, which is their burden to put into the record, if they all act together to cause the same indivisible injury, then they can get a dollar-for-dollar credit. But there are cases that say that because one defendant cannot be liable for another defendant's punitive damages, for example, that this defendant doesn't get a credit for the punitive damages paid towards the settlement of punitive damages paid by this defendant. And I refer the court to several of its earlier cases, or one of its earlier cases that was followed by another. And the case
of the settling defendants in the Stewart Title Company couldn't be liable for the insurance code violation, which is the only basis upon which judgment was rendered in that case.
If they produced the same actual damages, they could be jointly and severally liable for those damages, although not under that cause of action.
But in the Stewart Title Company, there were statutory damages, multiple damages, attorney's fees, and so forth and so on, and we held that that Stewart Title was entitled to a pre-trebling credit, regardless of the... whether they were jointly responsible for those actual damages under the insurance code.
Judge,
can you distinguish your argument from that?
Sure. Let me go at it this way. There's a prior Supreme Court opinion called Riley versus Industrial Finance Company, and it's not in my brief. Let me give you the cite. It's 302 Southwest 2nd, 652. And there are a number of, and there are several of these finance company cases. What happens is, guy owes. 17 finance companies, a bunch of money. They all call him and harass him. He sues them all, saying, I can't tell, you all damaged me, and I can't distinguish between each of you as to how much you hurt me. Okay? He sues them and claims that they are jointly and severally liable. He settles with all but one, or in the Riley case, the trial court severed out some of the others and made him try one. And they go to the jury on the question of, what did one specific finance company do to you? And the defendant, in that case, the finance company, objected and said, we cannot get a credit based on this submission that's given to the jury, because you're not asking about the whole of the plaintiff's damages. And without a question going to the whole of the plaintiff's damages, what's caused in common by everyone, we can't get a credit because you're just asking about our part. In our case, we tried the damages only as to first title. If you look at the submission, the liability questions asked only about what did first title do, and the damage question asked what damages do you find approximately resulted from, basically the liability questions as to what first title did. And so one of our positions in this case is the cases that segregate out where you ask as to a particular defendant govern here, and they're not entitled to a credit. But the second thing is, because we got to the end of the trial, and because there was no objection to the damage question as posed by the defendant, when we asked only as to what first title and Alamo title did, the jury did not get the full range of the damages as to both the sellers and first title. In other words, if we had asked the jury, what did the sellers cause and what did first title cause, we would have additionally asked about attorney's fees for the sellers, for the case where we sued the sellers. We would have asked about rescission and rescission-type damages. We would have asked about punitive damages. And all of those would have gone to increase the entire amount that the first title credit get credited against, the credit that they claim. What has happened is we have asked only as to the damages with respect to first title. That's why we tried the case. And as a result, when we take the credit from the prior, from the seller, and try to apply it to the damages against first title, it's not a question of whether or not we're getting a double recovery, we're getting double dipped. Because we're not crediting against the entire amount of damages, we're just crediting against what these folks said, or against what first title did.
What difference, excluding two damages, what other damages accrued to the buyer from first title?
The evidence at trial was the Garretts did not trust the seller. They had had prior problems with restrictive covenant, and they said, we would not close this transaction unless the title commitment showed us affirmatively that there were no restrictive covenants of record. And that is, in fact, what the title commitment showed. As a result, all types of reliance damages were basically incurred as a result of the first title's affirmative misrepresentation. They spent their life savings. They put in investing in this auto salvage yard. They put in, you know, 50 to 60 hours a week for months getting it ready to open.
With respect to the title company's alleged affirmative misrepresentation, what did the title company do in this case that was not done by title companies in the first place?
Well, Judge, in this case, what the title company did was they had a restrictive covenant in a deed that was in their file that they failed to disclose and further stated that there was none, which was affirmatively untrue. The testimony at trial was...
This was back in Sterling also.
I understand that. I take it
your view of the Court of Appeals' opinion in this case that if a title company lists none of record in a commitment, which it is required to do, if it believes that there are none of record, then it can be liable for that as a misrepresentation.
Yes.
In every case that a title company makes that statement.
Not in every case. In the Cheatham case, there was an express disclaimer that said, you know, you're not entitled to rely on any of the statements in this title commitment because it is for our internal purposes only and it may or may not be correct. The disclaimer in this case doesn't say anything at all about the title commitment. The disclaimer in this case says the title policy to be issued may or may not guarantee a particular use of the property. That is the only disclaimer in our commitment. And further, the evidence in the case was that the folks at the title company fully expected that all of the parties to the transaction were going to see a copy of the title commitment before closing and that they would rely on it to determine what the status of title was. No, it may not always be true. And further, there was, in fact, you know, the argument is made that the title commitment represents some type of internal examination to determine its own risk and that that's the only thing it represents. In this case, there was another internal examination that is found in the record that was not for public consumption, that didn't get sent out to anybody, where they testified, in this case, that it was used to gauge their exposure. In this case, they sent out the title commitment full well knowing that people were going to look at it and rely on it to see what the status of the title was. And in fact,
how is that different every case where you send out a title?
Judge,
is the buyer going to sit there and say, no, I saw that, but I didn't say that?
No, most of the title commitment cases, most of the title policy cases are cases where they didn't find an easement and didn't disclose it. That's where the duty to, you know, duty to find and disclose cases come in. The GAMI case out of Fort Worth was another restrictive covenant case that's an NRE case that said if you make an affirmative misrepresentation in the title commitment about restrictive covenant, which the representation none of record is, you're stuck with it. If it's false, it's false. And when people rely on it, you know, you ought to suffer some for the damage that occurred. In this case, I'd like to read to you a quote out of a second case. It is Western Guarantee Loan versus Dean, 309 Southwest 2nd, 857. This is on page 861. There's a second quote on page 871. It goes back to the arguments that we're looking not at the entire amount of damages as a pot to credit against in this case. In Western Guaranty, it was another finance company case. The defendants had again preserved their objection for the record that the question that's going to the jury as to this particular finance company will not allow us to have a credit because it doesn't ask about the entire amount of damages suffered by the plaintiff. And the court says, as we pointed out in our discussion of appellate third point, there has been no finding of the entire amount of damages caused jointly by all defendants. Obviously, until the entire amount suffered by appellee has been ascertained, the amount of the settlement cannot be credited on the judgment for damages. Furthermore, whatever sums the other defendants may have paid in settlement of Dean's claims for usury, double usury penalties, and for exemplary damages are not to be credited against whatever judgment Dean may recover for the entire individual actual damages. That is an NRE case. Now, it is the defendant's burden to bring before this court and before the trial court and the court of appeals a sufficient record from which the court could apportion the damages between what gets paid for punitives, what gets paid for attorney's fees for chasing after the sellers in the settlement proceeds. There is a case on that. It is Hill. If I can find it. Hill versus Budget Finance, 383-79. In Hill, it was exactly the same situation, another finance company case. And in Hill, the non-settling defendant put the plaintiff's attorney on the stand to prove up the settlement agreement. Asked him all kinds of questions. How much did you get? Who did you get it from? This, that, and the other. And in that case, they were all in the same case together, all the defendants and all the settling parties. And in that case, they had been pleaded to be jointly and severally liable. Not here, but in that case, they had been. And the court goes on to say, until defendant, non-settling defendant, all you proved to me was that there was a settlement and how much it was. You didn't offer me any proof about what the components of the prior settlement were, about whether or not they included exemplary damages, attorney's fees, things that would not be common actual damages as to all defendants that you're entitled to get a credit for. As a result, they hadn't presented a sufficient record, and the finding of no credit was allowed to stand. In this case, there's nothing in the record other than the sellers were sued in a different case. The suit sought money damages, rescission, and attorney's fees, and that our clients thought that at least one of the sellers had made knowing misrepresentations to them. There's no apportionment. There's no showing as to what of that was intended to run through exemplary damages or attorney's fees. Well, actually, there is on attorney's fees. $22,062 was to run through attorney's fees. In short, our position is the record does not support a finding that these are joint court feasors, and the judgment of the trial court and court of appeals ought to be affirmed on that basis. And further, they didn't object to the special issues as both Riley and Western Guaranty require them to do. They've waived whatever objections they have pursuant to those cases and 277 and 279.
Any questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Very briefly, if I might, for the first time today, we're hearing the arguments regarding lack of divisibility. It's not been addressed in the Court of Appeals. It was not addressed in the motion for rehearing. It was not addressed in the response to the application of the writ of error. This is truly the first time this argument has been articulated by the respondents in this case. However, even if it had been preserved, the defendants in this case have met their burden. As been pointed out by the court, this case is almost on all fours with the Sterling decision. The only difference in Sterling was the claim they didn't get the three lots. In this case, the issue was whether or not there was restrictive covenants. There is no question in the underlying case they sued the sellers for misrepresentation. Mr. Garrett testified to it in the trial transcript around pages 307 to 310. In the settlement agreement, he said, we sued for misrepresentation. Now, they raise an issue, well, they also sued for rescission. But we know from the record they didn't rescind the transaction. They retained the property. They say, well, we didn't break out attorney's fees. We know from the record on pages 307 and 308, attorney's fees were broken out. $40,000 and $22,000. $40,000 went to Mr. Garrett, to the Garretts. $22,000 went to his lawyer. It was broken out. The fact of the matter is they were suing for the same type of damages. You look at the charge, which is contained on page 50 of the transcript. The issue of which judgment is based is for misrepresentation, failure to disclose the fact that it was restrictive covenant. This is the same allegation they sued Garrett, or the Dameron and Jenkinson in the underlying case. This case truly is on all fours with the Sterling case. Now, they talk about, what about the punitive damages? Well, I don't think, first off, punitive damages, as far as we're concerned, is irrelevant because you cannot get contribution for punitive damages. We just don't think it's an issue as far as this case. Now, one thing that's noticeably absent in their briefs in the Court of Appeals, in the response to the application for writ of error, and now in the argument is there any case law that they've been able to find that requires a non-settling defendant to prove the settling defendant was a joint tortfeasor in order to get credit for the settlement, which was the holding of the Court of Appeals. They've not furnished this court with one single case that supports the proposition, that supports the position taken by the Court of Appeals in this case. And the reason we believe is that the law is just contrary, as this court so held in the Sterling case earlier of last year.
Can you distinguish the cases cited by Mr. Swain, the loan company cases?
5 minutes ago, I heard these cases for the first time. I have not had a chance to review those. But I think they are distinguishable in that in the loan company cases, you had all these different people, separate transactions, calling him allegedly harassing him. As was pointed out earlier by Justice Enoch, in this case, there is one transaction that's involved. That is the sale of the property. And the fact that they're suing on is the fact that there was a failure to disclose a restrictive covenant. Now, the issue of whether or not there was a failure to disclose by the sellers, by the title company, by the title insurer, you know, does that create separate damages? I don't think so. Because the fact of the matter is they wanted to use the land a certain way and they couldn't use the land another way. Now, as far as the finance company cases, you know, if we had some people calling them at night, harassing, some calling them at work, yes, you may have some different damages. But we know in this case it's the same acts they're complaining of and it's the same damages. Finally, with respect to some of the issues that were raised by Justice Heck, and that is whether or not even there was a misrepresentation or whether or not there was negligence, there was reference made to disclaimers in the title commitment. Whether or not there was reliance upon the title commitment, there was disclaimers as in the Cheatham case. In fact, we have those disclaimers listed on page 22 of our application. And the disclaimer was the policy to be issued pursuant to this commitment does not guarantee that the insured property has adequate title to allow it to be used, sold, transferred, lease or mortgage for any purpose intended by the purchaser. So the same type of disclaimer that was contained in the Cheatham case was contained in the title policy in this case. And we believe that the other points we've raised regarding whether or not we can even be sued on a title or a theory of misrepresentation or negligence are with merit. In conclusion, we would pray that this court reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals, give us credit, or in the alternative, remand the case for a new trial, or render judgment in our favor based upon the points we set forth in our brief. Thank you very much.
The foregoing causes are submitted to the court on the brief and oral argument. It concludes the business of the court as far as the submission docket is concerned. The marking is adjourned to court.
The audience, please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.